Thank you, Mr. Davenport, and thank you, Ms. Cole. I thought I should do that as well. Didn't want to leave anybody out. Actually, we're very thankful to be able to come down and sort of, I guess in a sense, repay all the times Mr. Dobson made the trip to Murfreesboro for us. And we'd certainly appreciated having him up there for, I guess it was four. I mean, my wife and I have been attending in Murfreesboro since 2011. But been associated with the church since I was born, and for her since she was 15. So I'm one of those people at the feast that raises their hand when they say, "Have you been here for 40 years or more?" And I don't look old enough, I know, but I still raise my hand because technically I was there, even as a little baby. Today is a very important day. It's the mid-Sabbath and the days of unleavened bread. This is not really part of my sermon, but I wanted to mention that there's a very important anniversary today, this evening, and that is the anniversary of Christ's resurrection. So think about that tonight as the sun is going down, that this is kind of an anniversary of that. I know we don't really call it out, but some people do know about that. In fact, the Jews usually read Ezekiel 37 on this Sabbath out of the prophets, which is interesting because it's the valley, it's the dry bones chapter, which talks about the resurrection. So it's just an interesting tradition that they have, that they observe. Anyway, this past week, and wait, let me start my timer. I don't really know how long this is going to be, but I hope we'll get out of here before 6. But I'm going to start a timer just so I get an idea of how long. Anyway, this past week, we have had a theme running through our lives, and that is being unleavened. I'm sure many of you, if you're like me, had to concentrate a little bit harder at the office. And I turned and looked at my wife last night and said, "I made it, because I don't have to go to the office anymore and before the feast is over." So this year I made it. I can't say that for every year. But as you know, you go to the office and there might be someone that brought in some donuts that day, or maybe a vendor came to visit and brought a whole bag of bagels and set them out on the table. And it's just so easy to just forget. You get in that routine and you go over there and you pick up a bagel and you start putting butter on it and you eat it. Now, hopefully you realize it when the butter's on it and maybe give it to your buddy and say, "I can't really eat this right now." But hopefully as we were eating the unleavened bread this week, I hope that we were thinking about what that means for us, the spiritual meaning behind it, that we are to be living lives focused on putting out sin and looking to that unleavened sacrifice that makes it all possible for us, Jesus Christ. Christ called himself the bread from heaven, and his acceptance by God the Father as the perfect offering for us was foreshadowed in a special offering that God commanded to be done after the Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread, and that's the wave sheaf offering. But before we get into reading about this particular offering, I'd like to give you a little bit of background material on the offerings themselves. Much of this comes from this book, which is called The Law of the Offerings by Andrew Jukes, written back in the 1800s. But I'd like to bring out some of the types that are presented to us by these offerings, and I hope that it will maybe bring a little bit more comprehension to what God commanded Israel to do. These were described to the Israelites in the book of Leviticus. And if you'll start turning over to Leviticus, we'll begin looking at chapter 1 of Leviticus. And this description of the offerings continues from this book, from this chapter on through chapter 5. Now, as I mentioned, Andrew Jukes wrote this entire book talking about the types shown by what we read in this book of Leviticus. I remember as a young person when we would get to this part of the Bible in a Bible reading program that I would think, why do I want to read about all of these offerings, and this man bringing a bull or some bread or flour or whatever, it just didn't seem to make a lot of sense to me until I read this book. And then I realized there's a lot of meat, there's a lot of material in these verses in Leviticus. So we're in Leviticus 1 and verse 2, and God starts talking to Israel about the offerings. He says, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of the livestock, of the herd, and of the flock. If his offering is a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish. He shall offer it of his own free will at the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the Lord. Then he shall put his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on his behalf to make atonement for him." And then it goes on to describe how he will kill the animal. And then there are several different types of this burnt offering that are described in the later verses. I won't go through those. But they present us with multiple views of what Christ did for us. He fulfilled all of the types presented in these offerings. The first three offerings described, the burnt, the meal, and peace offerings, were described as bringing a sweet aroma to God, or in some translations it says a sweet savor. In this case, with the burnt offering, as a sweet aroma to God, an accepted worshiper was wholly surrendering himself to God. Christ appears here as the man offering to God something that is most precious to him. Ephesians 5:2 refers to this class of the offering. And I'll just read it. We don't need to turn over there. Ephesians 5:2, and we're breaking into the chapter here, and it says in verse 2, "And walk in love, as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma." Here, the offering of Jesus is seen as something that delighted God. The way he walked and lived his life pleased the Father immensely. The sin offering was not described as offering a sweet-smelling aroma. So this verse is referring to Christ fulfilling the types presented by these first three offerings in the book of Leviticus. The burnt offering was not offered for forgiveness of sin. Verse 3 says this was to be offered of one's own free will. Speaking of the use of the word atonement, in verse 4, Duke writes, and I'll quote, "The word atonement here, as elsewhere, in itself means simply making satisfaction. And satisfaction may be of two sorts, depending on that which we have to satisfy. We may satisfy a loving and holy requirement, or satisfy offended justice. Either would be satisfaction. The burnt offering is the former. The sin offering is the latter. The atonement of the burnt offering is the satisfaction God receives from the perfectness which the offerer presents to him." That's from page 1661 of the Law of the Offerings. The burnt offering involved an offering of a life. Life was given, something that from the beginning God claimed as his. So here is a picture of what we owe to God, our duty to him, and the offering in the body of Jesus Christ is seen as fulfilling that duty to God, perfectly keeping the first four commandments. The burnt offering was wholly burnt on the altar, a type showing that our relationship with God doesn't involve just committing one piece of our life to God, but the complete surrender of everything to him. That's the burnt offering. Now let's move on to the meal offering. The burnt offering had the image of man fulfilling his duty to God. This offering lays out the imagery of man fulfilling his duty to his fellow man. Because part of the offering was taken, a handful of the meal offering was taken by the priest and burnt on the altar. And then the rest of it was eaten by the priest and his family. It also provided a sweet aroma, just like the burnt offering. Note the ingredients that are used here: flour, oil, and frankincense. Each one of these brings out a detail in how Christ fulfilled the sacrifice. A life is not given here, but the fruits of the ground are given. From the beginning, God's allotment to mankind was the fruits of the earth. Genesis 1:29, and God said, "See, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed, to you it shall be for food." But life was reserved to God. Even after the flood, when God allowed mankind to eat the flesh of animals, his instruction still was, "The life which is the blood you shall not eat." That's Genesis 9, verse 4. The importance of this difference between the burnt and meal offering is this. God claimed life as his, and in the burnt offering represented what man owes to God. The fruit of the earth is given to man and represents what we owe to our fellow man. In the meal offering, the gift of the corn and oil represents the fulfillment of our duty to our neighbor. God tells us in Leviticus 23, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." The idea being presented by this meal offering is of a man surrendering himself to God as a sweet aroma so that he may give his fellow man his due. One of the last offerings described by Leviticus is the sin offering. We're skipping over a couple of them, but for the sake of time. And here's what Andrew Jukes writes about this offering in the Law of the Offerings, pages 137 and 138. Quote, "But here, in the sin and trespass offerings, we read of sin in connection with the offering. Here is confessed sin, judged sin, sin requiring sacrifice and bloodshedding, yet sin atoned for, blotted out, and pardoned. The sin offering shows that sin has been judged, that therefore the sense of sin, if we believe, need not shake our sense of safety. Sin is indeed here preeminently shown to be exceeding sinful, exceeding hateful, exceeding evil before God. Yet it is also shown to have been perfectly met by sacrifice, perfectly borne, perfectly judged, perfectly atoned for." End quote. With that background, now let's consider the offering given for the wave sheaf. Let's turn over to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23, and we'll start in verse 10. This is where the holy days are laid out, and we get this particular detail of the wave sheaf. Leviticus 23 and verse 10. "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give to you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. He shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. And you shall offer on that day, when you wave the sheaf, a male lamb of the first year, without blemish, as a burnt offering to the Lord." Note that, burnt offering. "Its grain offering shall be 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, an offering made by fire to the Lord, the meal offering, for a sweet aroma. And its drink offering shall be of wine, 1/4 of a hin." We have not covered the drink offering, but if you want more information, pick up this book. Notice here that it doesn't mention a sin offering being presented. Just a burnt offering with its grain offering. Both of these, as we just heard, were types pointing to Jesus Christ's sacrifice. The burnt offering represented Christ's satisfying God's requirements, not just with his death. Remember that his death is really more pictured by the sin offering. This offering more represents his life, the way he lived his life, the way he gave himself to God with everything, with every breath of his life. It was wholly consumed by fire. While the grain offering represented Christ satisfying man's claim on his fellow man, as only a handful of it was burned and the rest was eaten by the Levites. No necessity, as you see, for a sin offering, as the wave sheaf represented Christ in perfection, being presented to God. So there was no need for a sin offering. If you read in many other places about some of the ceremonies that are done, especially with Aaron and the priest, normally you'll see it starts with a sin offering. Then they proceed to the other offerings. because they realize that they're bringing a man before God, and the first thing that needs to be done is a sin offering, and then the other ones. Where in this case, this is Christ being presented before God, and there's no need for the sin offering in his case. Let's continue on with verse 14. Leviticus 23 and verse 14. Ye shall eat neither bread nor parched grain, nor fresh grain, until the same day that you have brought an offering to your God. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. And you shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. Count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath. Then you shall offer a new grain offering to the Lord. The wave sheaf offered early on Sunday morning after the Sabbath during unleavened bread pictures the resurrected Jesus Christ being accepted on our behalf before God our Father. He is the antitype or a fulfillment for this wave sheaf. In Colossians 1:18, you don't have to turn to it, but he is called the firstborn from the dead. And in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 20, the firstfruits of those who have fallen asleep. Now, how many of you have pictured this offering as a bundle of barley grain stalks being offered and waved before God? I know that initially when I read about this, that's what I thought. I thought it was they carried some pieces of grain that they had harvested and took it in and waved it before God. And that was the wave offering. That's not what this is. Let's read more about this. That's how it starts. It starts out that way, but it doesn't get offered that way. The word sheaf is actually translated from the Hebrew word omer. Now, an omer is equivalent to a little over 2 quarts of barley flour. Here is a description of what actually happened to prepare the omer to be waved before God. First, I'd like to quote from the website, BibleTools.org's article on this, on the wave sheaf offering, concerning the timing of the cutting of the wave sheaf. Quote, though Scripture specifies the day the wave sheaf was to be cut, it gives no specific time of day to cut it. Jewish history from the Second Temple period gives an interesting insight. The second century Mishnah affirms that when the Sadducees controlled the temple, the sickle was put to the grain just as the sun was going down on the weekly Sabbath. The book Biblical Calendars states the Bethusians, or temple priest, reaped the first fruit sheaf at the going out of the Sabbath. That's end quote. That's end quote from the article on the BibleTools.org website. So around the time that Christ was resurrected from the grave, the barley that was to be used for the wave sheaf offering the next morning was being cut. Now let's look at the method used to prepare the omer, or wave sheaf, for the offering. And this is from the book, The Temple, Its Ministry and Services, by Alfred Edersheim. This is pages 204 and 205. Quote, when the time for the cutting the sheaf had arrived, just as the sun went down, 3 men each with a sickle and basket formally set to work. But in order to clearly bring out all that was distinctive in the ceremony, they first asked the bystanders 3 times each of these questions. Has the sun gone down with this sickle into this basket on this Sabbath? And lastly, shall I reap? Having each time been answered in the affirmative, they cut down barley to the amount of 1 ephah, or 10 omers, or 3 seahs, which is equal to about 3 pecks and 3 pints of our English measure. The 1 ephah, or 10 omers, of barley was cut down. Only 1 omer of flour was offered in the temple. End quote. Here we see that the barley grain was cut down on Saturday evening. The grain was then roasted and ground into fine flour to be presented as the omer or wave sheaf offering the next morning at around 9 a.m. Even the preparation of the offering points our minds toward Jesus Christ, toward the fiery trial he endured at the hands of the Jewish people and the Roman administration, and the intense beating that he endured, pictured by the barley being ground into flour. Christ told Mary when he met her in the garden on Sunday morning that he needed to ascend to his Father in heaven. Let's read that in John 20. John 20. And we'll start in verse 17. We'll read verse 17. John 20 and verse 17. Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I'm ascending to my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God." Christ had not yet ascended to the Father to be accepted on our behalf. Christ, as the true bread from heaven, fulfilled the types represented in this offering as he presented himself before the Father as the Omer to be lifted up, fine flour, unleavened and perfect. Now let's consider a couple of passages about Christ and the manna God sent to ancient Israel. John 6, John chapter 6, here Christ is speaking to the masses that followed him. This is before the Feast of the Passover. John chapter 6 and verse 48, Christ says, "I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world." Now let's go back to Exodus 16 and read about the manna, the original manna that Christ kind of refers to in John 6. Exodus 16. And we'll start in verse 11. This is after Israel was complaining. They were complaining, as they normally would, about not having food. And Exodus 16 and verse 11, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, I have heard the complaints of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. So it was that quails came up at the evening and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay all around the camp. And when the layer of dew lifted there, on the surface of the wilderness was a small, round substance, as fine as frost on the ground. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, 'What is it?' For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, 'This is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Let every man gather it according to each one's need, one omer for each person, according to the number of persons. Let every man take for those who are in his tent.' Then the children of Israel did so and gathered some more and some less. So when they measured it by omers, he who gathered much had nothing left over, and he who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need." I find it interesting that Jesus Christ describes himself as the bread of life that has come down from heaven, comparing himself with manna, which when they gathered it, as described in Exodus 16, an omer was sufficient for each person. Then in the wave sheaf offering, what was offered? An omer, a barley flour, was raised up before God, symbolizing again that Christ's sacrifice was sufficient to satisfy God to atone for the sins of this world. He is presented to God as the first fruits of the dead, the first omer of a mighty harvest yet to come at the return of Christ. We've all been called now to be part of that early spring harvest. The season of the grain harvest was a metaphor Jesus used in his preaching. There were two major harvest seasons in Israel: the grain harvest in the spring and the fruit harvest in the autumn. The spring harvest, which started with barley and ended with wheat, took place between Passover and Pentecost. Pentecost is also called the Feast of First Fruits because the season begins and ends with an offering of the first fruit harvest. The first was barley, the second was wheat. Christ used the harvest as an analogy for saving people. Turn over to Matthew 9. Matthew 9, and we'll start reading in verse 35. Again, that's Matthew 9 and verse 35. Then Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. And when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them, because they were weary and scattered, like sheep having no shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." You and I are part of that harvest that Christ is gathering now. We are part of that spring harvest, which is the early harvest of the first fruits. The wave sheaf was the first of the first fruits gathered. Once it was presented to God in the temple, the barley harvest could officially begin. The wave sheaf offering presents us with another picture or type of the perfect offering presented to God to be accepted on our behalf. It also is identified as the starting point for counting 50 days to the next holy day, the Feast of Pentecost. In this way, God is connecting, if you think about it, he's connecting Passover and unleavened bread with Pentecost. He says, start counting here and count 50 days out to here. Let's read that in Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23, back to Leviticus 23, and we'll start reading in verse 17. And you shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath. This is today. From the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. Count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath, and you shall offer a new grain offering to the Lord. You shall bring from your dwellings 2 wave loaves of 2/10 of an ephah. They shall be of fine flour. They shall be baked with leaven. They are the first fruits to the Lord. Here we see a representation of us. The loaves baked with leaven, the church. Here we see that God commanded his people to count up to the 50th day. And then we see another offering of grain that is also called first fruits. Again, these were types of the fulfillment we see today. We are among the first fruits being offered to God. The Jews refer to this period of time as counting the Omer. They feel it is intended to focus their attention on the laws of God as they approach the holy day that many believe was associated with the giving of the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai. In this way, they're ever mindful of the coming holy day. They actually have a way of basically saying what day they are every day as they go toward the 50 days. They're actually mindful of what that day is. If it's the 30th day, the 40th day, they actually know that count, and they keep track of it. In this way, they're ever mindful, as I said, of that coming day. And we have the count, and many of us know, I know that in our bulletin, and I think I saw it in here, that we put a little reminder in there normally. It says 5 weeks to Pentecost or 5 weeks to the Tabernacles. We normally have something like that that kind of reminds us too, that kind of says, hey, there's a holy day coming up and it's this far away. Well, this was a daily thing. For us today, perhaps God is reminding us that his plan for us doesn't stop with the redemption from sin through Christ's sacrifice. Our deliverance from spiritual Egypt and the removal of sin from our lives, as we're picturing with this holy day. But must continue. It must continue to the next holy day, which pictures the pouring out of God's Holy Spirit. God's purpose for his people cannot be completed without this essential ingredient. God's command to count toward the next holy day was designed to direct our attention to the next step in God's plan. The spring holy days, which begin with the barley harvest during the days of unleavened bread, and end with the wheat harvest on Pentecost, are designed to remind us of God's focus, His focus now, on the early harvest, on His first fruits. From the first Pentecost celebrated by the early church in Jerusalem to the day Christ's feet touched the Mount of Olives at His return, Christ and the Father have been focused on gathering that early harvest. And we are, as I said, part of that harvest. We are part of that offering that's presented, that was presented, the two loaves with leaven in it on the day of Pentecost. As we come out of this period of focusing on putting sin out of our lives, let's now begin to look toward the next holy day. Let's look toward Pentecost and focus on continuing to put sin out, to focus on God's putting God's laws in its place. As we focus on putting the Feast of Pentecost in our focus, in our minds, as we head toward that holy day.